From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we remember Beatle George Harrison, who died yesterday. We listen back to interviews with Ringo Starr and with Ravi Shankar, who taught Harrison how to play sitar. Also, we hear from actor Vince Vaughn. His film Made has just been released on video, and he's currently starring in the new film Domestic Disturbance. And actor Gene Hackman. He's starring in the new films Heist and Behind Enemy Lines. And film critic John Powers reviews Amelie. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. And I see it needs sweeping. Still my guitar gently weeps. I don't know why. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. U.S. warplanes are dropping bombs on Kandahar, the last Taliban stronghold, as clashes continue between tribal factions and the Taliban near the city. According to Afghan tribal leaders, round-the-clock negotiations are continuing for the surrender of Kandahar. NPR's Sarah Chase reports from the border town of Chaman in Pakistan.
Mahmoud Anwar, who's leading the opposition delegation in the Spin-Boldak talks, says Taliban there and in Kandahar have been given the last of a series of ultimatums.
Now the Al-Qaeda network and other Taliban are preparing themselves for us. They are reinforcing. And we are also doing the same. Our ultimatum will finish tonight.
Anwar says tribal elders, mindful of the destruction 22 years of war have wrought in Afghanistan, have urged the opposition forces not to launch an attack on the Taliban. And that's why the opposition keeps extending the deadline of its ultimatum. Anwar says Taliban demands include safety for Al-Qaeda members and help crossing the border for top Taliban officials. Sarah Chase, NPR News, Chaman, Pakistan.
An envelope sent to a home in Seymour, Connecticut, has tested positive for anthrax. The home is near Oxford, where a 94-year-old woman died of the disease last week. Governor John Rowland says the Seymour letter bore only traces of anthrax, so insignificant, he said, that it couldn't have made anyone sick. Israeli tanks and troops reportedly surrounded the West Bank city of Jenin early today. The move came just over 24 hours after a suicide bomber killed three passengers on an Israeli bus. President Bush has condemned yesterday's attack. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
This latest suicide attack comes as Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon begins a five-day visit to the United States, which will include an Oval Office meeting with President Bush on Monday. White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer said the president would use that session to again stress the need to find a way to stop the violence.
He understands the difficulty and the pain that is being suffered in Israel, and the United States condemns the bus attack yesterday. But that will not stop the United States or the president from working with the parties to try to bring about a solution, and that's why the president looks forward to the meeting.
A U.S. representative is currently in the Middle East trying to find a way to get peace talks back on track. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
The New York Police Department confirms it's offering mental health counseling to all 55,000 of its members. Commissioner Bernard Kerik says in a statement the goal is to help the NYPD and family members get through the difficult times created by the attack on the World Trade Center. Stock prices were mixed today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 22 points, finishing the day at 98.51 on volume of 1.3 billion shares. The Nasdaq Composite Index was down 3 points, finishing at 19.30. The S&P 500 dropped about a point to 11.39. You're listening to NPR News.
Something in the way she moves attracts me like no other lover.
Former Beatle George Harrison has died of cancer at the age of 58. Known as the Quiet Beatle, Harrison died yesterday at a friend's home in Los Angeles. NPR's Melissa Block reports.
The Union Jack was lowered to half staff at City Hall in Liverpool, England, where Harrison and the Beatles were born. Fans left bouquets at Harrison's mansion outside of London and at Abbey Road Studios. And in New York, crowds have gathered at Strawberry Fields in Central Park, an area near the apartment building where John Lennon was shot to death in 1980. George Harrison was 13 when he hooked up with schoolmate Paul McCartney, then with Lennon and later Ringo Starr. Harrison's songs included Here Comes the Sun, Something, and While My Guitar Gently Weeps. He incorporated the sitar into the Beatles' sound, and after the Beatles broke up in 1970, he organized the benefit Concert for Bangladesh in New York. He also produced 24 movies, including Monty Python's Life of Brian. George Harrison is survived by his wife Olivia and his 24-year-old son Donnie. Melissa Block, NPR News, New York.
Robert Tools has died nearly 5 months after becoming the first person to receive a self-contained artificial heart. Tools received the experimental heart July 2nd at Jewish Hospital in Louisville, Kentucky. He suffered from congestive heart failure, diabetes, and kidney disease, and had been expected to die within a month. House and Senate leaders tried to put the finishing touches on a procedure for opening negotiations on a compromise economic stimulus package. I'm Frank Stasio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Merrill Lynch, offering customized wealth management services for qualified investors. 1-800-MERRILL or www.askmerrill.ml.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. That's the Beatles' song, If I Needed Someone, written by George Harrison. Harrison, the Beatles' lead guitarist, died yesterday afternoon in Los Angeles after a long battle with cancer. He was 58. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we hear from two musicians who knew him well. In 1995, Terry spoke with Ringo Starr about the early days of the Beatles.
No, in the Beatles, did you have to, like, figure out who you were going to be in terms of your public personality in the band? Because everybody in the band seemed to get this, you know, public persona.
Yeah, I think mine just came in naturally as Mr. Dopey. You know, it's sort of like the comic clown, you know. John had their edge. Paul was Mr. Lovable. Well, I was Mr. Lovable, but the young girls loved him. George was this silent type, and, you know, I was, hi, what's happening? And so that image, of course, especially through Hard Day's Night, is, you know, I've had to battle that since that day. Everybody thinks, oh, that's what he's like. And, of course, he's not like that at all.
Can you give us a sense of what it was like early on when the Beatles' fame started getting, like, so extraordinary that you couldn't go places without attracting crowds? I mean...
Well, you know, we were young boys, and it was exciting where we, you know, we'd sort of conquered England. That was the first job, you know. Just to get down to London and get in there was heavy enough. And then we'd do the continent. You know, we used to have this thing, oh, well, we've done Sweden, we've conquered Sweden, we've done France now, we've done Italy, you know. And then, of course, we were invited to come to America. And at that time, we were really worried because we'd had two records out here, or they were coming out. Nobody wanted them. And by chance, George came over for a holiday. He was the first one of us to come to America. And, of course, he was going into record shops saying, oh, have you got the Beatles? And they were saying, excuse me, never heard of them. So, you know, he came back saying, oh, they don't know us over there. And, of course, you know, the story goes when Capitol decided to put some money behind us to promote us, and we got off the plane to do Ed Sullivan. We had a number one. I mean, you know, you can't plan things like that. This is just how it is.
Well, that first Ed Sullivan performance is one of the watershed moments in rock and roll history. What are some of your memories of
Ed Sullivan?
Of that show,
Well, Ed, you see, I thought, we come to America, and it was fabulous, and there was millions of people at the airport, and there were lying in the streets, and it was yeah, all over the place. And just my mind, I have a Ed to this day, and I don't know if it's actually true, but my impression was Ed Sullivan. You know, I'm waiting for Ed to say, you know, they are, they're all the way from England, and it's great, and they're going to be fabulous, and blah, 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 blah. And it's like Ed said, here they are. The Beatles.
Well, you probably couldn't just comprehend like
thrown,
the whole... Yeah.
Thrown to the lions. Right. So, to this day, I've always thought, God, I mean, we could have done better than that, Ed.
Well, you probably were unfamiliar with the whole Ed Sullivan phenomenon. I mean, the most
we didn't know what it meant.
Square person.
You know, we did not know what it meant. You know, this guy just booked us on a show. We'd go anywhere for a gig.
So when girls started screaming at your performances, did you have... Do you have any idea what was going on? Like, why the screaming as opposed to anything else?
It started in Liverpool, and
so you actually knew where it started.
Oh, I mean, it caught on like wildfire all over the world.
Was it frustrating to perform in concerts where you couldn't hear what you were playing because the audience was screaming so loudly?
It got frustrating in the end. At the beginning, it was just fabulous. I mean, you know, if you can imagine, you're 22, 23, and you go on stage. And all those people are just screaming at you, loving you. I mean, you know, you were making a lot of records and making good records. You know, it was everything you dreamed of. And it just built up and built up. And, of course, around about 65, you know, it started actually to get a little tiring because, you know, we were starting to make really interesting records and we couldn't perform them. And it didn't matter what we did, people were screaming anyway, so no one was listening. And because of that, we were becoming, you know, not the best musicians we would become because we could only play, you know, the actual thing. I mean, for me personally, it's very hard to do this on radio, but I could only do the downbeat, you know, check, 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 check. I couldn't do any fills or anything because they would just disappear into the cosmos. So... You found yourself, you know, you're just sitting there playing the track, really.
Do you have a favorite phase of the Beatles' recording years?
I think, well, you see, the very first record, you know, making the first records was just a thrill. I mean, it was absolutely thrilling. And listening to it on the radio, you know, we would stop the car when we'd be going to a gig somewhere, and you'd know... You know, because they didn't play them every 10 minutes. Oh, it's 7:45 on Wednesday. They're going to play your record. And so wherever we were going, we'd stop the car. We're usually in a car and listen to it. And the other thing we did, if it moved up the charts, we would always have a celebratory dinner. So if you look at Beatle photos and Beatle footage, you'd see them getting fatter and fatter and fatter as they were getting more popular because now we could afford food, you know. But and then, of course, from Rubber Soul on, you know, the record started to really get exciting. The sound, we were really getting into the sound, making good sounds. The writing was getting better. You know, everything was picking up. It was really getting good. So, you know, it had a natural progression. So, you know, to say this period or that period, they're all different periods. I mean, I like the White Album. That's one of my favorites just because I felt after Sgt. Pepper, which was brilliant, but it just doesn't happen to be my favorite. The White Album, we were getting back to being a band again. And, you know, that's what the Beatles were. We were a really cool band.
Ringo Starr from a 1995 interview with Terry Gross.
She once had me. She showed me her room. Isn't it good? Norwegian wood. She asked me to stay and she told me to sit anywhere. So I looked around and I noticed there wasn't a chair. I sat on the road
In the mid-60s, after the Beatles stopped touring, George Harrison went to India, where he studied sitar with Ravi Shankar. He became a follower of the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi and introduced the other Beatles to transcendental meditation. Harrison also organized benefit concerts for starvation relief in Bangladesh, featuring such performers as Ringo Starr, Eric Clapton, Bob Dylan, and Ravi Shankar. These events were precursors to later superstar benefits such as Live Aid. Terry spoke with Ravi Shankar in 1999.
Now, you've been very close to George Harrison. You've described him as being almost like a son, and he's described you as being almost like a father. You met him in 1966, and this was a period when all the Beatles seemed to be searching for some kind of spiritual help. What did you make of the Beatles when you met them? They were in this period of a kind of spiritual search. Did you consider that search to be an authentic search, or did you feel that they were very kind of confused about what they were looking for?
It was exactly what you are saying. They were confused and they were searching, but to tell you the truth, when I met them, I almost didn't know them or know anything about them, because I had just vaguely heard that it's a popular group. And it was on in a party that all the four were there, but it was only George that interested me from the very beginning, because of his being so inquisitive and asking me questions about music and relation to the religion and the spiritual aspect of it and the whole thing. And that's how we came close together, and he started having some lessons.
What did you think of the solo he played on Norwegian Wood?
I never heard it before, and it was only much later on my nephew and nieces, they played for me, and I thought it was terrible in the sense, in the sound that was produced on the sitar. The song was nice. I liked the song very much, but it was a peculiar sound. Even it didn't sound like sitar even. He had little lesson from a person in London who's a student of mine, who is to be in London at that time. And I told him frankly that it's fine, people like it and you are happy, but I didn't find it interesting enough, because the very sound of sitar, it is something which we have developed since last 750 years, and it's same like taking the violin, someone in Africa sings an African song and scratches on a violin, and how would you feel? Because you know what the violin sounds like.
Right.
The sound of violin has immediate effect. So it was the same thing, but he understood. And that's why he wanted to learn.
Ravi Shankar speaking with Terry Gross in 1999. George Harrison died yesterday at the age of 58.
Weeps with every guitar gently weep. I don't know how you were diverted, you were perverted too. I don't know how were inverted, no one alerted you. I look from the wings at the play you are staging, while my guitar gently weeps.
A 1968 demo recording of While My Guitar Gently Weeps. Coming up, a review of the new French film, Amélie. This is Fresh Air. A new film making a splash in France is also finding an audience here. The film is Amélie, and the director returned to France after making the 1997 Hollywood flop Alien Resurrection. Our film critic John Powers has a review.
There used to be a big difference between American movies and French films, at least the ones that showed here. American pictures were fast and opulent, but about as deep as a neon sign. French ones were slower and less fun, but more grown up in their themes and emotions. All that's changed in recent years, as the whimsical new film Amélie makes clear. Although the movie's a love letter to Paris and the French fondness for ideas about chance and destiny, its style is Hollywood hip. Amélie is a modern fairy tale set in a magical Paris at the time of Princess Diana's death. Audrey Tautou plays the title character, an innocent young Parisienne who works as a waitress and inhabits a world of cartoonish, sometimes poetic types. Failed writers, nasty grocers, eccentric painters who keep copying the same Renoir painting over and over. Amélie has a cosmic sense of justice and secretly sets about putting the universe right, finding mates for the lovelorn, helping grieving widows and abused clerks, and arranging for middle-aged men to find lost childhood toys that lead them into bouts of teary remembrance. A dreamy loner, she eventually stumbles across a possible soulmate, an equally dreamy young man who keeps an album of people's discarded ID photographs. His name is Nino, and he's played by Matthew Kassovitz, who looks a bit like the world's handsomest rodent. The question is, will Amélie, who's so good at arranging other people's destinies, be able to land the man of her own dreams? I saw the movie a couple of weeks after it opened, and by that time I'd heard about it from maybe a dozen people. What was odd about their responses was that nobody was lukewarm. Everyone either adored it or hated it. This struck me as apt, for the film's director, Jean-Pierre Jeunet, seems to have no interest at all in any kind of middle ground. He once made a terrific short film called Things I Like, Things I Hate. And Amélie itself introduces nearly all its characters by telling us the things that they love and hate. I started off loving the film, for the beginning is filled with wonderful touches, especially in the scenes of Amélie as a small girl who wears cherries for earrings and raspberries like thimbles, which she eats off her fingertips one at a time. Just like Moulin Rouge earlier this year, the movie offers something extremely seductive, an idealized vision of Paris. Actually, the word idealized isn't strong enough here. This is a utopian Paris, filled with nostalgia, where there are no ugly high-rises or racial troubles, where even the interiors of sex shops are gorgeously lit, and there's a memorable tang to everyone you meet. Here, fabulous things happen by chance. If Princess Diana's life embodied the tragic romance of royalty, Amélie's story is about the comic splendor and the miracle of proletarian life. Jeunet is very good at capturing small, often delicate moments of transcendent beauty. There's a marvelous bit involving a small boy and his marbles, another about cracking the skin of a creme brulee. Yet even as Jeunet's drawn to the wry and the fantastic and the gently melancholic, his style tends to be as overbearing as a Mack truck barreling down the turnpike behind you. He's constantly zooming in on people's faces, working up elaborate Rube Goldberg-style set pieces. There's one here involving a couple having sex. And he pounds every emotion like a gong. Not content to have a cute star in Audrey Tautou, Junet gives us so many close-ups of her simpering and smirking like Mr. Bean that about halfway through the film, you're begging for a cream pie. If you haven't seen Junet's other films, in particular Delicatessen and The City of Lost Children, such stylistic antics might well seem delightful. But if you have, you'll notice how he's cannibalizing ideas from his earlier work, including that gag about the couple having sex. And you'll be driven crazy at how a film that starts off flaunting its inventiveness grinds to a halt halfway through. The story simply runs out of steam. Were someone to show you any 10 given minutes of Amélie, you'd be so dazzled that you'd probably say, "This is really amazing. I want more." But 2 hours of full-fat whimsy is far more than anyone needs. It's like being force-fed a tureen of creme brulee.
John Powers is executive editor of the LA Weekly. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Vintage Books, paperback publishers of The True History of the Kelly Gang, the new novel by Peter Carey. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, actor Vince Vaughn on making films with Jon Favreau. Their film Made has just been released on video. He's also starring in the new film Domestic Disturbance. Also, actor Gene Hackman. He's starring in two new films, Heist and Behind Enemy Lines. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Vince Vaughn made his movie breakthrough in the independent film comedy Swingers, starring with his friend Jon Favreau, who also wrote and directed the film. Vaughn and Favreau teamed up again in the movie Made, which has just come out on video and DVD. Favreau wrote and directed the film. Vaughn is one of the producers. Terry Gross spoke with Vaughn last summer. In Made, the duo is initiated into the crime world. Favreau plays an amateur boxer who needs money, and at the urging of his do-nothing friend, played by Vaughn, they take a job working for a mob boss in L.A. Favreau knows they're in over their heads, but Vaughn thinks he's cool enough to fake it, which, of course, keeps getting them deeper into trouble. Here they are on the way to the job, flying first class for the first time. The flight attendant has just told Vaughn that he can choose from a selection of videos.
What's the overhead on something like that? What's the action that's going to come my way for the videos?
The action that's going to come your way?
Yeah. What's it going to cost me for the videos?
No, you're up front. Everything's free up here.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. See that?
Yeah. Oh, wait a minute. See now?
They set you up and make it like everything's free when I drop this on you. And I bet there's a hidden tax for this system. Excuse me, sweetie.
Yes, excuse me.
Where the drinks are concerned, is that a hidden tax? Does that fall under the complimentary upfront service as well, or is that something you pay for?
No, they're complimentary. Would you care for another one?
They're complimentary?
Yes.
You bet your ass I would. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Okay.
Thank you. Can I get a Cutty on the Rocks, too? Something a little stronger? Is that complimentary?
Yes. Thank yes.
You. Cheers, man. You hear that? Everything up here is free.
Okay.
I asked Vince Vaughn about that scene.
When John and I did Swingers, that was actually the very first time that I ever flew first class, going from Los Angeles to Venice for the film festival. And so when I was on first class, I was a bit overwhelmed by it. And I remember John being uncomfortable because I rang the bell and I asked some questions. But of course, you know, I didn't hit on the stewardess or flight attendant during that time.
What questions did you ask?
I was just like, are you this for free? And I said, you know, so if I want like, you know, a glass of champagne, that's free. And I could get more glasses of champagne. She was like, yeah. I was like, are you serious? You know, and I couldn't believe it. I was like, now not only is there like one movie I can choose from, but you're saying that there's like a list of videos and I choose the video that I put in. I can watch any video that I want to watch. And I was just amazed that that was happening. And Faz was kind of embarrassed, like, you know, act like you've been here before. And my point of view was, but I haven't been here before. Why should I cheat myself out of this first-time experience, you know? So then as we took it, you know, made in the movie with the mob, but made as far as being an actor having an avenue in, we exaggerated it then for the comedy and also for who the characters were and what they had to serve for the overall story of the plot.
There's also first times in New York and a swank New York hotel. Did you have any of those first-time experiences yourself where you maybe said something inappropriate or acted too overwhelmed by the riches?
Yeah, the biggest one that sticks out was, I remember that, so we do Jurassic Park, which was like, I went from like Swingers and did this other little film called The Locust, and I go to, which was a very small budget as well, to The Lost World, and I was just amazed by the toys and the amount of people that they had and the time that they had to shoot. And when that was over with, there's a thing called Toy Fair, which I'm familiar with because my dad is actually a toy salesman, but they made toys and stuff for Jurassic 3, and so now you go to Toy Fair, and they're sort of selling the toys to the buyers, which would be like Toys R Us or any of those franchises. And so they asked the actors to come, and like we had to come out like with lights and stuff like that and be a part of it and like meet the people and stuff. It was a very odd experience. And they said, you have $150, or I think, in incidentals, which means that, you know, the mini bar and, you know, the telephones included in that in this case and room service and that kind of stuff. So I thought it was like $150 for the 3 days I was there, so I was budgeting. And then I realized afterwards, because Jeff Goldblum was there, that it was actually $150 every night I could have spent in the room. But I was like budgeting and thinking that $150 had to go over the whole time. And I was just amazed by that number figure to be spent in a day on sort of pleasantries, you know.
Well, something similar happens to your character in Maid. He's told by Peter Falk, who's like the mob guy who's assigning them a job, he's told that they have a daily stipend, and your character thinks, oh, and what is that?
Right, the per diem.
The per diem, yeah.
First time I heard that was on Location, hired as an actor, and they said you have I didn't know what the word per diem meant at all, and they said this is your per diem. I just thought, like, boy, am I getting over on these guys, they're giving me some cash money up front, you know.
You and Jon Favreau also start together in Swingers, which, like Maid, he wrote and directed. And in Swingers, you played somebody who was very naive and is reluctantly led into Vegas by you. Because he's broken up with his girlfriend, and you think Vegas is just what he needs.
Yeah, exactly.
And you're really arrogant and really faking it with a lot of flair in this movie. Let me play a short scene. This scene, this is your first time at one of the casinos with Jon Favreau's character, and you're demonstrating to him how to pick up a cocktail waitress at the casino.
Right.
I walked around for an hour with that stupid scotch on my track.
Yeah, you got knocked out pretty fast.
Oh, a couple of high rollers like yourself.
Can you believe it?
I'll go get you that scotch.
You know, forget about it. I didn't even want it. I just wanted to order it.
Well, can I get you something else? I mean, you really shouldn't leave here without getting something for free.
Why ruin a perfect night? Listen, bring a single malted Glengarry for me and one for my boy Mikey here. And if you tell the bartender to go easy on the water, then this 50-cent piece has your name written all over it, okay? I want you to run along because I'll be timing you. I'm going to keep time. One, two, three, four. What an a**. Baby, that was money. Tell me that wasn't money.
That was so demeaning.
She smiled, baby.
I can't believe what an a**. You are.
No, baby, she smiled.
She was smiling at what an a**.
No. She was smiling at how money I was. What I did with her.
Could we get out of here all right? Because I'm not going to pay for a room.
Mike, what the hell do you want to get out of here for? The honey baby's bringing us a cocktail.
What are you, nuts? You think she's coming back here?
Baby, I know she's coming back here. Did you even hear what she said? You shouldn't leave without getting something for free. Baby, she wants the party. She wants to.
Vince Vaughn, in this scene, we heard one of the catchphrases that you became well known for after Swingers, which was, "You're so money," or "That was so money." That's a phrase that you came up with for the film?
Sort of. I mean, it's sort of a Frankenstein, that phrase, because money existed in sort of a sports culture or hip-hop culture, but sort of going, "You're so money," and or "You're so money, you don't even know it." It was sort of the phrase that caught on, which was the "you don't even know it," and "you're so" is sort of what I added to it. And I used to say that a lot, half-jokingly, with John when we were friends. And, you know, Swingers was based on a real-life experience in that he did break up with his girlfriend in order to move out after he filmed Rudy to pursue acting, and he was really kind of, you know, in a bad way about it. And I sort of, you know, took him out, and the places that I took him was the Dresden and the Derby, and I was sort of into swing music in that lounge scene. And of course, you know, John exaggerated for comedy's sake. We always look at comedy sort of an overcommitment to the ridiculous. So the fact that, you know, Trent would say this and believe it so much and sort of spin it as if this was the ultimate truth and you had to get this down is, to me, kind of pathetic. I was always sort of surprised that Trent was perceived as cool.
Were there people who thought that your character was so cool in the movie they tried to emulate you?
I've heard that, yeah. I've had people come up and say, "Well, boy, I'm the Trent in my group," or this. I just always thought it was funny because I always just thought, like, you know, these guys, I mean, you look at the movie, we're like playing video games, you know? It's not like, the only girl I think Trent ever goes home with is the waitress, and it doesn't really work out with him. They go in the back and knock some stuffed animals off the couch, and that's about it. And then it gets interrupted, you know? But I think that Trent had a real innocence to him. You know, he's not maniacal or manipulative, but not from a complete understanding of what he's doing. I think he's very innocent. I think a lot of men, young men at that age, it's just sort of the thing of, it's such a big deal in a way. I think it shows women is very powerful because all this time and all this attention is spent on sort of how do we communicate with the opposite sex. So in a way, I think it really shows the power that women have, especially where men are concerned.
Swingers was really the movie in which you were noticed. What was your life like when you were working on Swingers with Jon Favreau?
Well, it was, you know, very much in the moment at the time, meaning there was no plan of anything. You know, we did the movie for $250,000 in like 21 days, so it was completely off the radar. And part of the reason we were able to do it so cheaply is a lot of it was illegal. We didn't get all the permits and things that you'd need if you were a larger movie that was being tracked or on the radar. A lot of the places that we shot at did us favors because we knew the owners, and they let us shoot there for free. And it actually, you know, gave the movie a great feel that it felt very authentic, that these were the people that would be at those places, and it brought a real energy that worked for the movie. But it came from a place of economics, of that was the only way we could get the movie done, and in a way that really served it and made the movie better. And making of Swingers, honestly, Terry, I was just looking to get tape to get an agent. I didn't have an agent at the time. I mean, I didn't know what would come of the thing. You know, we were putting this thing together, and we had read the screenplay for a year, trying to get it set up so it was like a play. We were able to go and shoot and get it, make our days very quickly because we all knew our stuff very well. But, you know, there was always a hope or a dream that it could get bought or that it could be seen, but the odds were just so against it. And we were lucky in that we did what we wanted to do and what we thought we found funny and sort of true for what our life experience was. You know, we didn't portray in that movie ourselves out to be, you know, street guys or, you know, really overly successful with girls or dealing with heavy problems of drugs and stuff like that, because that wasn't our experience. We were really out-of-work actors playing video games who liked girls and were sort of trying to figure out what was the best way to meet girls. And And I think by being simple and telling the story, not having things go good in Vegas, I think it became something that was somewhat universal and a lot of people could relate to.
Actor Vince Vaughn. His film Made is out on video and DVD. We'll be back with more of Terry Gross's conversation with him after the break. This is Fresh Air. Back now to Terry Gross's interview with actor Vince Vaughn. He stars in the new movie Domestic Disturbance.
I want to ask you about another role that you played, and this was in the movie Clay Pigeons. You play a cowboy who's very glib, who turns out he's a con artist and not to mention a serial killer. Mm-hmm. How did you envision the part?
Well, I saw it as to make it not so serious and have it be sort of funny and not take it so serious so that it could come off like a bad HBO movie. And I was fascinated by the response to Trent to some degree, and I thought, well, can you play someone who's killing people in a way that has all these what's considered to be pleasant social graces and still have him be liked by people, give him a point of view and some sort of, you know, really messed up code that somehow he followed, and go on that journey with sort of this guy who, how he perceived himself and all these sort of things. And I guess I've always been more drawn and fascinated to those kind of characters because I find it more interesting. And also it's sort of my life experiences are people that I knew. I mean, I would go to the racetrack as a little kid. My dad would take me all the time. And a lot of the people that I met were colorful people, interesting people. And a lot of them, you know, good people, but hustlers, you know. But with my dad being a salesman and sort of the people that I met, I was always really just sort of fascinated by that mindset.
Well, in this scene from Clay Pigeons, you're at a bar, you've just walked in, and you're trying to pick up a character played by Janine Garofalo. And there are, as you mentioned, kind of traces of your character Trent from Swingers in your approach here. Let's hear it.
Damn! Good-looking girl. Drinks Johnny Walker Black. Even pays with her own money. I can't wait to start dreaming nice.
You're very colorful.
Oh, you don't know the half of it. I'm like a big fireworks show. But very bright. Like light bright.
You know what? No offense, but this seat is saved.
Who for?
First guy not wearing denim.
You're not from around here, are you?
What makes you say that?
Well, you don't look like the town much. You don't. My name's Lloyd. I won't bite you.
That's a plus, Lloyd.
That's a scene from Clay Pigeons. Vince Vaughn, do you want to say anything about that scene?
Just that, you know, that was my favorite scenes in the movie was with Janine Garofalo. I think she's incredible. And some of that was improvised, and she's just so great and so available. It was really very easy to respond off of her. I mean, I knew I had the burden of Janine, who's a very bright, sophisticated person, although she's playing this character and she knows ultimately that she has to give in to me because that's, you know, the script and sort of where we need to take it for the movie. So she's open to that. So my job's a little easier, but I knew it had to come off believable that you bought that I made her laugh or that I got her to be open to talking to me. And so, you know, I went in there with a real specific point of view and really the biggest thing with those kind of things are listening and really paying attention to her movement and her talking and seeing what, you know, what was the way in to this particular person.
You grew up in Minnesota. Would you describe the neighborhood that you were from?
Well, I didn't really grow up in Minnesota. I was born outside of Minneapolis.
You grew up in Chicago, right.
I lived there for about a month. My dad was a salesman for Swift Meat Company, and he was transferred. I lived in Minnesota for 1 month, and I was raised in Buffalo Grove, which is sort of a middle-class suburb in Illinois. And I lived there till I was 8, and then I moved to Lake Forest, Illinois, which is an upper-class suburb of Illinois.
Now, I read that you were in a class with problem kids. Is that correct?
Yeah, you know, well, the thing, as time has gone on, people have learned more, but I went into a class one period a day. They would make me go to a classroom with, you know, maybe 10 or 12 other students all who had no obvious sort of retardation or anything, but it was more learning disabilities. But for me, it was like, you know, and I sort of felt like McMurphy in Cuckoo's Nest, and I've said that before, and that you'd have the tallest girl in the whole school. She would never talk. She'd never raise her hand in class. But, you know, you sort of look at that and say, well, this girl's already sticking out in a sort of way. Maybe she doesn't feel like raising her hand, you know. And I think most of the people there had more to do with sort of an emotional position based on a physical thing. Chuck Suitmeyer was in the thing, and his parents were still farmers, and he dressed differently than everybody else. So that probably had more to do with it than anything else. But we would go, and it was embarrassing because you'd be 10 years old, and you'd go for one period a day, and they'd make you play Candyland. And everyone in the school knew you were going to this classroom. So as you're struggling to have a social life, that was definitely something that was a hindrance. But it was really a gift for me. I mean, in a way, it made me be, I think, more outspoken and that sort of thing in order to have friends. And I was always very popular and well-liked, not just by one group, but I think by most of the kids in my school growing up. And I felt a need to sort of counter that by, I think, being funny and having a sense of humor and maybe being a bit confrontational with teachers and that sort of thing. And when I first went into the class, I was very kind of mean to the other kids, and I felt like, I don't belong here. These kids are, you know, these kids are crazy. I don't belong here with these kids. And then that kind of grew into me feeling very connected to them and very protective of them and, you know, going out of my way to try to include them and, you know, whether we were playing kickball at recess or whatever, I would go and, you know, pick them for my team, and I felt very including of them after a while.
What was your learning disability?
I don't know. I don't know what it was. I think I just had a short attention span, and I think everyone learns differently. I mean, I was in all normal classes. It was just that, you know, certain kids who they felt like needed one class a day to go, but it was not like the class was effective. There was nothing that was done. There was just a place to put these kids. You know, and all the other people that were in the class were all fine and very capable people. And I think probably had more to do with a family home experience or a physical thing in school or maybe, you know, a dyslexia that was, you know, better understood now today than it was in the early 70s. Sort of the thing to do then was sort of throw Ritalin at it, you know.
Yeah, were you ever treated with Ritalin?
They said that they wanted to put me on Ritalin. My mom gave it to me one time. And I reacted badly to it. And then both my parents, my dad, and said, you know, there's no way my son's going to go through life doped up. There's just, you know, how can he process or learn anything or mature or grow if he's not, doesn't have his senses about him, you know? He's not going to be able to process things. I was lucky that my parents were, you know, had that sort of vision. A lot of parents went through it, I think, with their kids. But, you know, when the school's telling you it's the right thing and it's helping them, like, you know, it's hard to say that they did bad. But my parents, I was fortunate enough, knew that that wasn't the right thing.
Vince Vaughn recorded last summer. His new film is Domestic Disturbance. Coming up, actor Gene Hackman. This is Fresh Air. Gene Hackman has three new movies this season. He currently stars in Heist, also in Behind Enemy Lines, which opens today in most theaters, and in The Royal Tenenbaums, which is due to open December 14th. Terry spoke with Hackman in 1999. His movies include Bonnie and Clyde, The Conversation, Mississippi Burning, Unforgiven, The Quick and the Dead, Get Shorty, and Enemy of the State. Hackman won his first Academy Award as narcotics detective Popeye Doyle in the 1971 film The French Connection.
All right, Popeye's here. Get your hands on your heads. Get off the bar and get on the wall. Come on, move. Move.
Come on, sweetheart, move.
Come on, move out.
All right, come on.
And face the window.
Move.
Face the wall.
Turn around there.
Turn around.
Move.
Come on, move. hands out of your pocket.
Turn around.
Come on, you heart. Come on.
Turn around,
come
big on. Man. Come on, turn around. Get on the wall. Get on.
Get him up.
Turn around.
Get him up.
Turn around. Hey, you dropped that. Pick
all
it up.
Those hands up.
Pick it up. Come on, move.
What are you looking at?
All right, bring it here. Get your hands out of your pockets. What's my name?
Doyle.
What?
Mr. Doyle.
Come here. You pick your feet. Do you? Get over that. Get your hands on your head.
When you were preparing for your role as a, you know, narcotics cop for French Connection, how did you see this role as comparing to other cops that you'd had that you'd seen portrayed in movies?
I try not to look at that kind of thing as an actor. I try to only look at characters and the script in a way that is always fresh for me. I ask myself a few very basic questions about how is this person like me? How is this person unlike me? And in answering those things is where I usually come up with the character.
Would you be able to tell us how you answered them?
Well, there's some very obvious things where I ask myself, for instance, in The French Connection, I would say, to myself, am I a policeman? No, of course not. What does it take to be a policeman? If I can really be honest about myself, given my personality, my physical makeup, what kind of a policeman would I be? Would I be able to do certain things that are required of me in this story? Yes, maybe. If I say to myself no, then the next question is, well, what do I have to do in order to convince somebody that I am capable of doing that?
So when you ask yourself, what do I have to do to become that person in a role, what answers did you give yourself? What did you have to do to become that person?
Well, some of it was pure acting, and some of it, as I said before, that sometimes I would say to myself, I couldn't do this. I couldn't say that line to that character in reality. So then I have to ask myself, If you say you can't say that in reality, then how are you going to act that? I would then give myself a situation where, under some circumstance, I would be able to do that. I would relate to an argument, possibly, that I had with somebody at some very high voltage time in my life, to the point where I could say, okay, given the right circumstances, I can do that. Now, I will now try to recreate that moment, just to speak in layman's terms, for myself by doing it in a sensory way. What was I wearing that day that this event took place? What was the weather like? What was the atmosphere? What was the... And be very specific about that so that then I can recreate a situation for myself that is similar to the situation in the script.
You know, you were talking before about how when you do a character, you have to ask yourself, what's similar about me in this character? What's different about me in this character? What would I have to do to fill in the gap between what he would do and what I would do? In at least two recent movies, you played characters with a real sadistic streak, the sheriff in Unforgiven, and the sheriff in The Quick and the Dead. And these were characters who definitely had a strong sadistic streak. What do you do to get in the spirit of a character like that?
I find in me a sadistic streak. I find something in me that may not be very attractive, but that I feel would be valuable in this context. I think if you search hard enough, you can find a lot of elements in yourself that you can use as an actor. You know, under certain circumstances, we're all capable of murder, I suppose. So you just have to find that circumstance. Sadism, I suppose, is not something that I find very attractive, but I guess there are certain things in me that will elicit that kind of thing.
Well, on screen, you know, the great sadists always have a lot of charisma.
Well, that's true.
So it must be fun to play roles like that.
It is. It's always more fun to to play heavy than it is to play a good guy. My kids are always asking me to play these things that are grandfathers and kindly old gentlemen. And I just tell them that, you know, it's not that I dislike watching that kind of thing, but for me to play it is not as interesting.
Do you get offers for kindly old gentlemen kind of roles?
I have, yes. I have grandfathers and things like that that are all-knowing and wise and all that, and it they just don't interest me.
You've actually dropped out of acting a couple of times, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Yeah, well, I thought I wanted to paint. I thought I wanted to do a lot of things, and once I started doing those things, I found that I didn't have the skill that I pretend to have as an actor, and so I kind of drifted back to it.
Well, that's
I think if you've done it as long as I have, it's very hard to drop it. You know, there's something very seductive about acting.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you come to work and there's 90 people standing there waiting for you to do something. And there is something both very heady and seductive and unattractive about that.
Gene Hackman, speaking with Terry Gross in 1999. His film Behind Enemy Lines opens today. He also stars in The Royal Tenenbaums, which opens in 2 weeks. We'll close today's show with George Harrison's song All Things Must Pass. This is the demo he recorded in 1969. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Sunrise doesn't last all morning. A cloudburst doesn't last all day. Seems my love is up and has left you with no warning. It's not always been this great. All things must pass. All things must pass away. Sunset doesn't last all evening. A mind can
support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Sometimes I Dream in Italian by Rita Cerisi, a novel of sisters by the author of Pink Slips, and from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, helping nations deal with legacies of abuse. A talk with Paul Fonseil, who heads the International Center for Transitional Justice. Fonseil was executive secretary of South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. He's now helping the UN develop a justice policy for post-Taliban Afghanistan. Join us for the next Fresh Air.